freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. The only way they can inherit the freedom we have known is if we fight for it, protect it, defend it, and then hand it to them with the well-taught lessons of how they in their lifetime must do the same. And if you and I don't do this, then you and I may well spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it once was like in America when men were free.
Welcome back, everyone, to Patriot Coalition Live. I'm Jason Marocek. Thanks for joining us today. The goal of this podcast is to create a timeless resource to teach about the U.S. Constitution and the proper role of government, the importance of America's Judeo-Christian heritage, and how to defend against threats to our republic. If you would like to send us your questions and comments, please send them to freedom@patriotcoalitionlive.com. That's freedom@patriotcoalitionlive.com. I'd love to hear what you enjoy about the podcast and how it has affected the way that you view liberty, our Constitution, and our country. Our sponsor this week is conservativeeconomy.com. So we now have a free speech alternative to Amazon, and that is conservativeeconomy.com. So why continue to spend your money with Amazon when they are canceling and censoring those who stand up for liberty, when you can spend your hard-earned money with freedom-loving companies who share your values and your principles? We have tons of companies to shop from with over 1,300 categories of products. Yeah, that's a lot. And there's more being added every week. So chances are you're going to find what you're looking for at conservativeeconomy.com. And if you shop at a business that you love and you think that that business would be a great fit at conservativeeconomy.com, go to our contact page and let us know. And if you own a business, go to the Sell Here link at the top of conservativeeconomy.com and tell us about your business. Again, that website is conservativeeconomy.com. Okay, well, let's get into today's episode. We are blessed to have with us today Glenn Whitner again. He's joining us for a second week in the row, and it's going to be great to get his concept and his feedback on this topic.
Morning, everyone. Let's have some fun with this.
Yeah, welcome. So the title of today's episode is Article 1, Section 7, Passing Bills and Resolutions in Congress. So this is part two of a two-part series on Article 1, Section 7, right? Because there's kind of two separate clauses. Well, there's three clauses, but two separate kind of topics in there. So as a really quick review, in Article 1, it's all about Congress. You know, the Section 1 of Article 1 tells us that our legislature is bicameral, meaning that it's comprised of two different branches or chambers and is granted all lawmaking authority by the Constitution. Section 2 is about the House. Section 3 is about the Senate. Section 4 deals with the times, places, and manner of congressional elections. And Section 5 addresses how Congress may conduct business in each of their respective chambers. And then Section 6 deals with congressional pay and privileges. So if you missed any of these episodes, or if you didn't catch part one of two on Section 7, they're all archived for you along with our show notes on our website at patriotcoalitionlive.com. So again, today we are talking about Article 1, Section 7, and today we'll be covering Clauses 2 and 3. So let's start with Clause 2. And I'm going to read right from the Constitution. It says, quote, every bill which shall have passed the House of Representatives and the Senate shall, before it becomes a law, be presented to the President of the United States. So that's the first part of it, right? And I stopped it there for a reason. We're going to go through this a little bit at a time because it's important that, you know, they did speak a little bit different and wrote differently back then. And so it takes, a little bit, and sometimes it's easier to carve it up in pieces. So far, so good. You know, this is telling us that after a bill is approved by both houses, both chambers of Congress, the House and the Senate, it must be sent to the President. Most of us probably remember that from our time in civics class.
Or from that show, Schoolhouse Rock, or not Schoolhouse Rock, but
a bill we call the law.
I'm just a bill, just a bill. Sitting on Capitol Hill. That was one of my favorite cartoons.
Oh yeah, that was awesome.
But what it doesn't talk about is, you know, when the House and the Senate, and it's one of the things we discussed in a different conversation, mm-hmm. was a lot of people think it's just the House that comes up with the bills, then sends it to the Senate, and then sends it to the President. But actually, the Senate can come up with its own bill and then send it to the House. And if the House doesn't make any adjustments, then they send it to the President. Or if they do make adjustments, it goes back to the Senate, and it can be, you know, go back and forth like a tennis match, depending on, you know, who's writing the bill and who's making the changes.
Yeah.
One question exactly I did have for you was, can the President introduce a bill?
The short answer is no. Okay. So the only way that a president would be able to even get his legislation into a bill is if he brings either a representative or a senator into the Oval Office, or goes to visit him, which is probably not likely, and says, hey, look, this is what I want. I'd like to have a bill written that says this. And he can tell them what he wants to write, and the representative and the senator can either say, that's a good idea, that's a bad idea, either way, but only a representative, a member of Congress, can introduce a bill.
Right. So that's why he has executive orders.
He does have executive orders, which, you know, have been abused for decades. And we'll get into that probably when we get to Article 2. But, right. You know, so he is not able to introduce a bill. Only the Senate, a member of the Senate or the House of Representatives, can do that. And so you bring up a good point, right? We did last week in episode 27. We talked about how there is a specific type of bill that only the House can introduce, and that is a bill for raising revenue, basically taxes.
Right.
Anything that generates money, only a member of the House of Representatives can do. But every other type of bill, to your point and your question, can be introduced by either a member of the House or a member of the Senate. And just to reiterate what you said, a bill cannot be changed. Well, let me rephrase that. Any bill that is written by one chamber that is sent to the other, if they agree with it, if they vote for it without any changes whatsoever, it has to be the exact same bill, then it goes directly to the President. But if they make even one change, a comma, a period, you know, anything that changes the bill, they'd have to send it back to the other chamber for them to approve the change, right? So the bottom line is that both chambers have to agree on the exact same version of the bill that's worded the exact same way before right. It can go to the President. Hence your reference, very apropos to a tennis match, right? If they keep changing things on each other, it can go back and forth until they both agree, and then it can go to the President. So
what's also interesting is the timing of these things. I think it was a couple months ago when Trump was still president, that they had this bill, I think it was the stimulus bill, that was so thick and so big and so broad. It had like 9% to do with actual COVID stimulus funding. They had like 11 days to review it and decide. It's like, how could anybody digest that much information? And who do they have that comes up with all that? I'm pretty sure these senators, who are not all that bright, in my or congressmen, you know, aren't sitting there writing down the legislation line by line. That would take an inordinate amount of time. But these, I mean,
yeah, they've got staffers and lobbyists.
Can they warn peace faster?
Yeah, no, and you're right. They can be hundreds, if not thousands, of pages long, depending on the type of bill. And that's why, you know, again, it's not the way it's intended to be, but the lobbyists are writing these bills and saying, here's what we want you to submit. Or, you know, maybe they'll have their staff go through it and make some changes before they actually submit the bill. But regardless, your point of, you know, being able to actually digest, deliberate on a bill before it's signed. Sometimes they have 24 to 48 hours on hundreds of pages, which is just absolutely ridiculous. Years ago, you know, as most of you know, I'm the executive director and co-founder of the Patriot Coalition. We asked one of the members of Congress to sponsor a bill called the Read the Bill Act, RTBA, basically requiring them to read a bill in its entirety on the floor before it can be voted on, so that everybody. So anyway,
that might shorten them up a little bit.
Yeah, well, that was the intent. So anyways, moving along. So that was the first part. So just to recap, the first part says every bill which shall have passed the House of Representatives and the Senate shall, before it becomes a law, be presented to the President of the United States. So the next section says, if he approve, he shall sign it. But if not, he shall return it, meaning the bill, with his objections to the House in which it shall have originated. Who, meaning that chamber of Congress, shall enter the objections at large on their journal and proceed to reconsider it. Okay, so let's break this down a little bit. So if the president signs it, it just becomes a law, provided it is within the constitutional authority of Congress, which most of them aren't, and which we're going to talk about when we get to the enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8, starting probably next week, and the Supremacy Clause in Article 6. So again, if both houses vote for it and the president signs it, and it and it's a constitutional, it's within the constitutional authority of Congress, it is a law. If it has nothing to do with the enumerated powers of Congress, and both House and Senate approve it, and the president signs it, it's what we call an unconstitutional enactment. Yes, it was enacted, but it's not law because it doesn't conform with the Constitution. So that's if he signs it. If the president doesn't sign it, the bill has to be sent back to the House, as we talked about, that authored it. So if the House authored the bill, sends it to the Senate, they approve it, it goes to the president, and he does not sign it, he has to send it back to the House because they're the ones that authored it. And along with it, he has to send back his objections to the bill in written form, because once it arrives, that chamber, in this case, the House, they have to write down the president's objections in the journal and debate the bill again. Now,
so now if they debate the bill again and they adjust it, do they still need the two thirds? Or if they, that two thirds is only if they want to vote on the bill as is.
Yeah. The two thirds that they, at that point, they only debate on the bill that was presented to the president. He sends back their objections.
I think I'm jumping the gun a little bit here.
No, that's okay. Yeah. If he sends it back with objections, they can vote on it as is. Right. And say, oh, yep, right. We're going to try to get, more support for this or not. Or they can write a new bill. They can do one of the others. But, so the key point here, and I think that you pointed this out, nowhere, we've heard the term veto, but nowhere in the actual Constitution, right, does it say the word veto. And so veto is just, it's a Latin term for, I forget, it's like, I disapprove or I reject.
Forbidden.
This. I forbid it. Yeah.
I forbid. Yeah. That's what we looked up.
Yeah. And so, so that this is what we're talking about, a veto. If the president sends it back with his objections, that is called a veto. Okay. And the journal that they have to write it, his objections in, is the same journal that we talked about in episode 24. So it's the one where they have to write down his objections.
Okay? It's interesting, the vernacular that they use in the Constitution does not say the word veto, because the word veto seems very final, very, very, that's the end of it. Don't bring this in front of me again. But in the way that the media spins it, especially if they're talking about Trump or some other Republican, they make the word veto sound like some kind of a bad word. But if it's a Democrat, vetoing, they're like, oh, he's doing the right thing. It's the veto. It's interesting. It'd be an interesting study to find out when the word veto, the first veto was actually done by Washington, but it'd be interesting to see when they started to use the word veto. The process to which the president disagrees with or disapproves of the particular bill.
Yeah. And that process, that hasn't changed, because that's written down in the Constitution. It's just a matter of when they started actually calling it a veto, what they call, tomato, tomato. They can call it disapproval or rejection or veto. And it's the same process. But yeah. OK, so the next clause says, now we're talking about now the veto. It says, quote, if after such reconsideration, meaning after the originating House reconsiders the bill that was just vetoed. So it says, if after such reconsideration, two thirds of that House shall agree to pass the bill, it shall be sent together with the president, with the objections, to the other House, by which it shall likewise be reconsidered. And if approved by two thirds of that House, it shall become a law. Okay, so now this is after a veto, it goes back to the originating House, they reconsider it, if they're going to try to, what we call today, overriding that veto, they have to get 2/3 of the originating chamber. Then once they've gotten 2/3 votes for it, they have to send it to the other chamber and they have to reconsider it. And if they also vote with a 2/3 majority, vote to approve it, then that bill becomes a law, again, assuming and provided that it is within the constitutional authority of Congress. So this is what we call the overriding of veto.
So this is actually interesting. So when you look at politics from an outside perspective, and the president doesn't veto, he signs a bill that he knows probably is wrong or probably isn't appropriate or he doesn't like, but somehow it has passed with bipartisan support in both the House and the Senate with already over or close to a 2/3 majority, you know, which hasn't happened in recent history.
But yeah.
You can see where the president might approve that to save face so that he doesn't get slapped down by the two houses of Congress, which would create a whole other media circus for him. So it's interesting, you know.
We all know they don't need a cause for a circus.
Right. Well, it's interesting from a strategic point of view, you know, that might be sometimes why a president who we thought had better sense approves something that he knows will probably, you know, go against him anyway, type thing.
Yeah, but you and I come majority, from the same school of ethics and morals. We have the same upbringing, if you will, from the military. And, you know, right is right, wrong is wrong. You know, you choose the harder right. You know, my personal favorite motto, you know, principles only mean something if you stick to them when it's inconvenient. So, yes, he may know that he's going to get overridden, but he did everything he could. He can, you know, look himself in the mirror the next day and say, look, I did everything I could. They overrode the veto, but it's wrong. And I cast my vote, you know, my veto is wrong. So I think we still should expect that of our presidents to do right thing.
Yeah. We absolutely should. And it's the quintessential discussion of politics over ethics.
Yeah.
You know, the two are not, you know, usually the same under the same roof.
Because politics
tends to be self-serving, and it's all about what you can get your other person to agree with or not agree with based off of you compromising your morals and ethical standpoint.
Yeah,
you know, we really need to get some enlightened statesmen back into the government to help lead us, you know, back into the light, you know, and get out of the gray area.
Totally agree. Yeah, it was, I think I may have mentioned this before, but it was, I think it was North Carolina's first governor, or at least one of the first, Zebulon Vance, who said, if you find that you have scoundrels and scalawags in Congress, you got to turn them out and you got to keep turning them out until you send honorable men to Washington. Now that he was talking about, you know, Congress, but the same goes for the president, et cetera. So
wasn't it Franklin who also said that you will not always have enlightened statesmen at the helm?
Adams, but yeah, one of the founding fathers
said that
enlightened statesmen will not always be at the helm, and that was their warning to us that look, you can't just cast a vote and that's it. It's not like, you know, fire and forget in the military, right? No, you don't cast your vote and that's done. You got to keep your eyes on them and you got to make sure they're doing what they're supposed to do, because they won't always be enlightened statesmen. And even if you think that they are and they arrive as enlightened statesmen, we all know what the swamp does to people, right? So regardless, keep an eye on them. So
my father-in-law has a theory, or not a theory, but this is what he believes, is that people start off enlightened. Hmm. They don't get into politics some do because they want power, but most do get into politics because they want to, you know, make a palpable change. But what happens is that you give away pieces of your soul every time you step up to the next level. So if you start at as the city council and you are making compromises and backdoor deals, even though you're trying to do a good thing, you're still compromising your integrity and your belief system in order to do the good thing.
Yep.
It's like, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul. And what happens is as you go from the council to the mayor, to the city or city or state legislature, and then from there to the national scene, by the time you get to be a representative or a congressman, you've given away pieces of your soul to the point where there's nothing left, and you are basically beholden and owned by lobbyist parties that help you get into power.
Yeah, it's
one of the reasons why they were so fearful and so aggressive against Trump, I believe, because Trump paid for his own campaign and owed nobody anything.
Right, beholden to no one. Yeah, that's why I've often said that. Look, you know, you shouldn't compromise on your principles. You just shouldn't, right? If you're compromising on your principles, it's not a principle; it's a preference, right? Right. Principle tells you what you should or you shouldn't do. You know, it's only after you have determined based on your principles that you should or shouldn't do something that you can now compromise on the degree to which you might do that, right? You might, right. How much money should be given to this cause as opposed to should you do this cause? And that's where the compromise should happen. So it's a slippery slope, as you point to. And well, I'll say,
nice is if we could have some politicians that would come out and say, hey, look, I can't get this bill passed. I can't get this passed because this person over here said that if I don't do X, Y, and Z, which is unethical and immoral, that they're not going to pass this. So I want to get it passed, but this person is not allowing it to pass because they want me to compromise the ethics and the morals and the reason why you elected me.
Yeah, or more likely situation is I'm against this because it is unconstitutional, but such and such is putting leverage on me, or they're trying to cajole me or extort me into voting for it using X, Y, or Z. Yeah, I'd love to name names.
Yeah, and that goes back to that thing we were talking about yesterday, you know, having a channel eventually one day, you know, God smiling on us and helping us get back to constitutional governance and back to, you know, the Judeo-Christian values, ethics, and morals, our moral compass that our country once had, is having a station that basically posts the unvarnished truth.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, this
just
is
the facts, ma'am.
Yeah, this is what the left's saying. This is what the right's saying. These are the facts.
Yeah.
Draw your own conclusions.
Yep.
Okay, this didn't pass, not because this person hates this person or that person thinks that person's racist. It didn't pass because these lobbyist groups want this to happen in these areas, and if that doesn't happen, they're not going to support what we're trying to do. Right. And you know, just let the American people make the decision, because that's really what our founding fathers wanted us to do, is as a people to govern ourselves.
Yeah, very, very well said. Okay, so let's move along in Article 1, Section 7, Clause 2. Continuing on, it says, quote, but in all cases, all such cases, meaning the reconsideration of the votes to override a veto. But in all such cases, the votes of both houses shall be determined by yeas and nays, and the names of the persons voting for and against the bill shall be entered on the journal of each house respectively. So it's just basically one extra requirement for overriding a veto, is that when they take these, they reconsider and they vote on it, they have to make a record in the journal on who voted for and who voted against the bill. So right. I think that's good. Anytime you've got some transparency, that's key.
Well, what would be great, and if we could get smaller bills, you know, passed,
amen.
Is getting the people of America to understand what their representatives are actually voting for. Most people don't do the research. It's not publicized. Hey, these are the senators that voted for this. These are the senators that voted against it. Or these are the House representatives that voted for this or against. And this is what the bill says. And this is who it helps. And this is who it doesn't help.
Yeah.
This is, you know, and being transparent. Like you said, transparency. The problem is you have a War and Peace bill that is so thick and so big and so convoluted that nobody could really understand what's in it. And then you have people voting for it because they've read sections of it that they either agree or disagree with. And then when it actually passes or becomes a law or a an enactment, an unconstitutional enactment, there's nothing we the people at that point can really do. And we don't really understand or know what was in it or how it's going to affect us in the long term. You know, that's the kind of transparency that we should have.
Yeah, I would say, yeah. So there is something we can do, and we will get into that. Again, it gets back to interposition. It's just essentially ignoring an unconstitutional enactment, but it takes, you know, elected officials. It takes, your community to actually step up and articulate why it's unconstitutional and then say, here's what we're going to do about it. But
I agree with that. And I'm totally on board with that. What I'm trying to say is, if we have the transparency to inform, especially those people who are not well informed and they don't try to be informed, but they have if they had a place where they could get informed and say, hey, look, this is the bill, this is who voted for it, and drill it down into the local area and say, hey, look, your representative voted for this and it's basically gonna, you know, mess up your life, your business, your world, because, you know, well, they don't care about you. Or, hey, this bill has, you know, $100 billion that's slated for the enemies of freedom all over the world.
Yeah.
Why are we funding people in the rest of the world, and when we are ourselves in debt? We're going in debt to fund people.
Yeah. No, and you make a great point. I think probably what we'll do in the upcoming series on Article 1, Section 8, because it will be a series, we're going to dig in pretty deep on it, because that's the crux of all the legislation that comes out. I think what we'll do is we'll do a segment. Part of that series will be on how to research bills, how to see what the justifications for the bills, at least in the House, are, how to find out who voted for them. I think we'll probably do some work on that.
Okay. Honest, I don't know how to do it.
Yeah, I've no, and you're not alone. I mean, there's a lot of folks. I didn't know how to do it until I finally said, you know what? What is the big hubbub about? And so I tried to figure out how to do it. So it's like anything else. Until you do it the first time, you know, you're a newbie at it. And I think we'll do something on that. That'll be a good idea. Okay, so moving along in this clause, it says, quote, if any bill shall not be returned by the president within 10 days. So in other words, both houses have voted for it. It's sent to the president, but if he does nothing on it, it says, if any bill shall not be returned by the president within 10 days, Sundays excepted, after it shall have been presented to him, the same, meaning the bill, shall be a law in like manner as if he had signed it. And then there's an exception here. Unless the Congress, by their adjournment, prevent its return, in which case it shall not be a law. Okay, so let's break this down into kind of two separate parts. So now here we are, we're talking about what happens if the Congress both approve of a bill, and they send it to him, but he does nothing with it in 10 days. So he only has 10 days to veto a bill and send it back to the originating chamber of Congress. If he doesn't meet this timeline and Congress hasn't adjourned yet, then the bill becomes a law, again, as long as it's within the congressional authority. Right. So it's kind of like a fail safe that he's, you know, he just says, oh, I don't want to touch this bill, I don't do anything. Well, if you're not going to do anything about it, if you're not going to oppose it, then it becomes a law. Now, the exception to that, and the framers anticipated Congress playing dirty. I know this is hard to imagine, but Congress, without this clause, Congress might wait until the end of a session of Congress and then pass a bill they know that will be vetoed, and then quickly, but instead of having it vetoed, they're going to quickly adjourn. So the president cannot return a vetoed bill to them because you're gone, and his objections, you know, whatever his objections are. So this is why the framers allowed for what we now call a pocket veto, because rather than sign it, he simply slips it into his pocket until the end of the congressional session. Right. So, again, this is to prevent Congress from playing dirty. You know, if they send it to him at the very end of Congress and they say, we're out of here, you can't veto this. No. It doesn't work that way. So
and that's where, you know, President Trump had the opportunity in December, the end of December, to do a pocket veto on that just ridiculously large stimulus package, that War and Peace book of garbage.
Yeah.
That was thrown up by the House and the Senate. He could have disapproved it.
Yep.
I mean, you know, all the Republicans in the Senate were also under the gun, because it's like, why did you approve this? You know, it's not constitutional. You know, it has a whole bunch of stuff in there that is absolutely unnecessary for stimulus relief. But yet they went ahead and passed it and threw it onto the president's shoulders. Well, he had the opportunity to do that pocket veto.
Yep. Because he just slipped in his pocket. That's it.
He didn't take it. It was like, why? Why would you do that? So, I mean.
Yeah. And, you know, again, my my guess is, you know, because there was it was tied to all of the stimulus money and, you know, heartstrings were pulling at him and so forth. But again, it doesn't relieve him of his responsibility. The oath that he took, same one you and I did, support and defend the Constitution. You cannot support and defend the Constitution if you're violating it, right? And so it required a veto to do the right thing. Now, granted, he did a lot of awesome stuff. He did some great stuff for this nation. But yes, like everyone, like you and me, we're not perfect. He's not perfect.
It was just disappointing on his way out. And the way that he had to leave with the commander in thief that's currently sitting where he's not supposed to be. You know,
Traitor Joe.
Commander in thief. I mean, it's just that whole couple month period after the November election was just, there's so much that was wrong with it. But that last little thing that he could have vetoed, that he should have vetoed, was just kind of like, why?
Yeah.
We're counting on you, man. You know?
Yeah,
and that was the $400 stimulus that everyone's like, oh, we want 2,000 per person, and it was like they offered up 400, and he's like, well, and he was a proponent for the 2,000 originally, so it's like, well, why did you approve the 400? I mean, 400 is not going to do anything for anybody, and everything that's in the stimulus is what you're against anyway. Just don't sign it. Don't just do anything with it. Just let it die.
Stick it in your pocket. Yep, that's right. Okay, so the final clause in Article 1, Section 7, it's fairly long, but I'm going to read it in its entirety because it's almost a duplication of what we've talked about, and we'll talk about the difference. It says, quote, every order, resolution, or vote to which the concurrence of the Senate and House of Representatives may be necessary, except on a question of adjournment, shall be presented to the President of the United States. And before the same shall take effect, meaning the same order, resolution, or vote, it shall be approved by him, or being disapproved by him, shall be repassed by 2/3 of the Senate and House of Representatives, according to the rules and limitations prescribed in the case of a bill. So again, that's kind of long, but what this is saying is, in the last clause, it only said, in fact, it starts with, if any bill, and it's very specific about the word bill. So then actually it was Madison, James Madison in the Constitutional Convention, who kind of realized, he's like, and he said, quote, if the negative of the president, meaning if the veto of the president was confined to bills only and not orders, resolutions, and votes, he says, it would be evaded by acts under the form and name of resolutions, votes, et cetera. He proposed, you know, Madison proposed, to put in the words, or resolve should be added after bill. So it was Madison's kind of thought that, look, if you just put bill in there, they're just going to say, oh no, we're going to call this a resolution and get around it. So again, the framers
the politicians
knew,
trying to play dirty pool, and he knew that it would eventually happen.
And the framers were wise to the ways of man, sinful man. And so this clause, all it does is says, look, everything that applies to a bill applies to orders, resolutions, or vote in which the concurrence of the Senate and the House is necessary, with the exception, they said, of adjournment, right? So the House and the House and the Senate are solely responsible for when they adjourn. And so they accepted that. So that's all this does, is it applies the rules for a bill to orders, resolutions, or votes. Okay, so that covers both clauses, the last two clauses in Article 1, Section 7. There were some interesting kind of nuggets that we came across, and we'll scoot through these, but I wanted to kind of bring to your attention. It was interesting that Colonel George Mason in the Constitutional Convention, they were talking about how this is when they're trying to figure out, what do we do about the executive branch? Is it one super all-powerful magistrate, as they called it then? Does he get to veto any bill no matter what, you know, without even a chance of overriding? They even talked about having three executive officers, three presidents, if you will, co-presidents. So it was during this discussion that Colonel Mason started talking about, how powerful a magistrate can get in a kingdom, and the advantages of whether or not to make them powerful or or less than all powerful in a republic, right? And so he's, and I'm going to paraphrase kind of what he said because it's kind of a long diatribe, but there are some key facts in there. He's talking about how the monarchies are so powerful because, you know, the kings, they have, I think the words are, they can use secrecy. In other words, you don't have to share it with anybody. They have dispatch, meaning they can do something very quickly. They don't have to wait on, you know, rule by committee, and with vigor, right? They can vigorously do all the things that they need to do. So all these seem to be advantages of a monarchy. But despite that, he says, in one of the most critical pieces of preserving liberty, and that is, you know, preventing being overrun by your neighbors, you know, in a war or some sort of conflict, he says, this invincible principle, talking about the principle of republicanism, is to be found in the love, the affection, the attachment of the citizens to their laws, to their freedom, and to their country. So that's a quote from him. He's talking about, look, right, despite how important and strong monarchies are, republics have, if not, you know, as much, if not more advantages, you know, these invincible principles, he calls them, where, you know, he gives examples, and I know Glenn, you're a military history buff, but he gives the examples of like the cluster of Grecian republics able to resist almost constantly, you know, attacks from the Persians, the monarchs in Persia.
Right. And the battles and the armies that the Persians were able to put into the field were, in the hundreds of thousands. Mm-hmm. And they would go up against armies of the Greeks that were in the tens of thousands.
Yeah.
And even the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC, the Greeks threw them back into the sea. And then 480 BC is when they had the Battle of Thermopylae, where you have the famous Spartan 300,
yep,
battle at the Hot Gates. And you had 7,000 determined Greeks fighting for their hearth and home, who were able to repulse over a 300,000 man army and kill almost 25 to 30,000 of that army before they were overcome. And they were only overcome because of duplicity and somebody who betrayed them.
Yeah. So. Now, obviously they had some pretty good geographical advantages, but more so, as you said, they're fighting for hearth and home. And that was right. Mason's point is like the monarchs, you know, their armies are fighting probably, you know, oh, we're going to go in another war again. You know, the king, you know, is really ticked off at, you know, the neighboring king or whatever, or our republic or the neighboring republic. And so they're fighting for what? Because their king told them to. Whereas these right. republics like Greece, Holland, you know, when they were in the 30 Years' War against Spain, is the same situation. Right. Or the Swiss cantons, because they're in the middle of a whole bunch
down,
of.
You can even drill down further, because a kingdom is set up a bunch of vassal states create a kingdom. The king doesn't just own everything. He has allegiance from his dukes, his barons, his earls, who all have their own section and people that they're responsible for. Mm-hmm. So when the king says, hey, look, I need an army, the people who are fighting for that baron will then, you know, follow the baron who's now fighting for the king. And so the level of loyalty was very convoluted.
Yeah.
If you love the king, great, because you're fighting for the king. But the problem is that men die and they're replaced by lesser men. And eventually those kingdoms were being ruled by people who were not all that bright, kind of like Congress. But the bottom line is that their loyalty was not to the king, it was to their earl. And so it got real convoluted. When you had like the French Revolution, that changed the French's loyalty from being one of servitude to a vassal system to being patriotic.
Yeah.
It allowed them to follow Napoleon, and they fought harder because they're fighting for their home. They're fighting for their people. They're fighting for their country. And that love of country is almost a more powerful weapon than almost anything you can imagine.
Yeah. Yep. And actually, Colonel Mason, he finishes his little diatribe, his monologue, if you will, talking about in the late war, meaning the war of independence. He says, without arms and without soldiers, without trade, money, or credit, in a manner destitute of all resources, but we must ascribe our success to this pervading all-powerful principle. And as you said, you know, to hearth and home, you know, to actually fighting for something you believe in. Okay.
And,
so we thought
we did.
Yeah. And we did. And we came
we
out the victors.
Pulled off a miracle with God's grace.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So we just thought that would be an interesting for us to share with you. So getting into kind of our summary, Glenn, any final thoughts?
One thing that we didn't touch on was the fact that the two-thirds majority in the Congress and the Senate is that we've got to be careful. And as a conservative, I would love to have a conservative Congress, but then that creates other issues and other problems because we never want to have one group or one people have so much power and authority that it basically negates the power of the president.
That's right.
So the reason why the two-thirds majority is in there is because our founding fathers knew there would rarely be anything that two-thirds of the gathered statesmen would agree upon and want to fight against.
Right.
Very few times have we had that overwhelming, and usually it's in time of warfare, when we're declaring war on Germany or in 2001, when we were going to fight against Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, then you had overwhelming majority. I mean, hardly anybody disapproved.
Right. Yeah. No. So you bring up a good point. It's important. I mean, it would be a dangerous thing. As much as we love our side of the fight, you know, with the current crop that we have in Congress, I'm not sure I'd want either side to have a two-thirds majority,
right?
Where, you know, somebody with maybe some common sense, if that's to be ascribed to a president, certainly not the current one, would be able to say, let's, you know, slow your roll. Let's take a look at this. This is not a good idea, and be able to veto it without, you know, being able to have an easy overriding vote. So,
and that's why it's so important to fix this election system that we have.
Yeah.
Because we cannot allow these spikes like we saw in the Georgia elections for the senators and in the presidential election, where at the 11th hour, apparently it's now a commonplace thing where we stop an election, wait for, you know, fake votes to spike the thing up for the Democrats so that they can pull out some amazing victory where initially they were being defeated. So, but fixing that election system so we have trust, faith, and confidence in our election system and our process is so important. And that's why, you know, with what's going on in Georgia and currently in Texas, you know, talking about fixing our election programs is very important.
Yep. Absolutely agree. Okay, so just a really quick summary of Article 1, Section 7, Clauses 2 and 3. Essentially, they're making sure that there is a clear separation of powers, that horizontal separation of powers between branches of our central government. And so, you know, obviously, the legislature has its job, and that's to write the bills. The president has his job. He can either approve it or disapprove it. But he at least has a say in saying, no, that's a dumb idea. It's unconstitutional. Or if he has, you know, they have a great idea for a bill and he says, no, I don't want that. At least the Congress has the ability to override his veto. So it's a good way. It's a brilliant way to still separate those powers, but allow the process to continue. So that's what today was all about. So thank you so much for joining us today, Glenn. I appreciate you coming on the podcast again. It's always great. It's fun. It's a fantastic discussion. Yeah. And so, I, you know, go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying. I'm going to go ahead and do a plug for Conservative Economy.
Absolutely.
And I'm going to speak from the heart. You know, we all know that, and anybody who watches this and wants to know more about constitutional governance and wants to know about how to fix the problems that we see in our country. We know that a problem has come up with regards to the three-headed beast, right? The big business, big tech, and what's the third one?
Mainstream media.
Mainstream media. The constant lies that keep being thrown at us and hurled at us, and the power, the monetary power that they have and that they wield, basically indiscriminately. The only way to fight that is to create our own parallel economy as conservatives, as God-fearing Christians, and as men of principle. In order to do that, we have created a company called Conservative Economy, where you can come and spend your hard-earned dollars and take away that power and take away that influence from the three-headed beast.
Yeah.
So when you shop with us, you're shopping with a purpose, and you're shopping for a cause. We are a cause. We are not here to make money for ourselves. We're here to create something that will allow us to break free of the chains and the shackles that bind us from this three-headed monster that has risen up over the last decade. So at conservativeeconomy.com, you weaken those who mean to do us harm, and you empower freedom-loving companies, and you help us out, and you also help out this podcast. So please shop at conservativeeconomy.com. That's conservativeeconomy.com.
Well said, brother. That is well said. I appreciate that. Okay, so if you're not already a regular subscriber, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts, at places like iHeartRadio, Spotify, and the like. And with that, thanks again, everyone. Really appreciate you tuning in, and we'll see you here next time.